The military vote, the Latino vote, and the distribution of a COVID-19 vaccine. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Early voting numbers in Florida have already surpassed what we saw in 2016. But there's one group whose vote could be coming in late. We're discussing the absentee ballots from soldiers. How big and influential is this vote in the Sunshine State? We'll talk with the general who led the U.S. command in Afghanistan under Obama. Also, Republicans and Democrats are fighting for every last Latino vote in Florida.
The Latino electorate tends to underperform, which means not come out in the numbers that its population would suggest.
We'll learn how the Biden and Trump campaigns are trying to woo these voters. Finally, once a vaccine is created, who's going to get it first? Florida has a plan in place, but there are questions about who may be left out. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. In this election cycle, military service members and their families are a key voting bloc. And Florida has one of the largest military populations of any state in the country. Tens of thousands of the service members out there are currently overseas voting through absentee ballots. President Trump won the military vote handedly in 2016. This time around, a number of high-ranking officials are supporting the Biden campaign. General Stanley Allen McChrystal is the former top commander of U.S. and international forces in Afghanistan, serving under President Obama. He led the Joint Special Operations Command in Afghanistan, and he joins us now. General, it's such a pleasure. Thank you.
It's my honor. Thank you.
So, General, I want to get to your support of the Biden campaign in a moment, but I've got to start with this news from overseas. As of this afternoon, it's been reported by NPR that, again, three people were killed and many more injured in the city of Nice in France. It's being reported now as a terrorist attack. National security has not been a topic discussed at length during this campaign. How vulnerable is the United States right now to a terror attack?
I think the United States remains very vulnerable to terror attack, not just the traditional kind, as this was a knife, as I understand, but also things like cyber attack or even the introduction of viruses that could cause a pandemic. So I think our security remains a critical part of what we should be thinking about.
How has our system of intelligence gathering and information sharing with foreign allies changed over the last 4 years?
Well, we have some good relationship with allies, but they're not as good as they used to be. I mean, quite honestly, allies are looking for consistent partners that give respect as well as receive respect. And I think that the concept of America first or America alone weakens our ability to be part of a broader alliance against things like terrorism.
So this leads into the fact that you are supporting the Biden campaign. Why do you believe Biden is the candidate that is best positioned to ensure America's safety?
Well, thanks for asking. For one, I think the two candidates in this race are better known to the American people than probably any previous race. We have seen Joe Biden for decades, to include 8 years in the vice presidency. And then we've seen the president in 4 years. So we have a lot of insights. And the four things that jump out to me about Vice President Biden is, first, the ability to build and lead a team, the ability to get good people around him. If we look at President Trump's inability to maintain talent, look how many people joined his team but then left, and some under very bad circumstances. And then the second is the willingness to give and receive loyalty back from people. You know, that's the kind of thing that, you know, relationships are critical to military people. You learn just how important your close comrades are. And what we see is, over many years, Vice President Biden has built some deep relationships, and I have great trust that he'll leverage those in the future. Then the other two that jump out, integrity. The willingness to be candid, to be honest with the American people and with your peers. And I think that's just bedrock. And then finally, the ability to respect other people, to listen to other people, not to be demeaning to any group or any individual. That kind of respect is what made the military a very special place to live, because you felt, regardless of rank, that there was an underlying respect for each other's service and professionalism. And I think Vice President Joe Biden can bring that back to the nation.
All right. Some people will remember you did, as I mentioned too at the beginning, is that you, you know, were in your position under the Obama administration. So you've worked with President Biden before, and you haven't always seen eye to eye with him. I mean, you disagreed on the approach to the Afghanistan war in terms of the number of troops that were needed, and President Obama did fire you for comments made about the vice president that were published in a Rolling Stone article. Why do you support him now? But help me understand, what was that difference that you guys had with each other?
Well, this probably ought to make my endorsement a little more genuine, because we had deep policy differences. Vice President Biden and I had different views on what we should do in Afghanistan. But here was the deal. Every time we worked together, he listened. He expressed his opinion, I expressed mine, and I felt like mine were being taken into account and being considered. In fact, President Obama, in fact, decided to go with the recommendation that I made over Vice President Biden, but it didn't harm the relationship there. So you ought to be able to disagree on items of substance. You ought to be able to argue about those, but at the end of the day, there ought to be an underlying belief that we're all trying to move the nation forward. And that's what I always felt with Vice President Biden and President Obama.
And you know what? Help me understand that, what the ideal relationship should be between generals and the commander-in-chief to basically to protect the country. I mean, what should that ideal relationship look like?
That's a great way of putting it, because go all the way back to the founding of the nation. Our president is the commander-in-chief in the chain of command. And that's different from some countries. And so in reality, the military all works for that leader there. At the same time, the military brings special expertise. You've spent a lifetime learning what it is to do the intricacies of warfare. So I think there's got to be a deep respect in the civilian leadership for the expertise of the military. But on the other hand, policy is decided by civilians. It should be advised by the military. So you have to have a synergy between the two sides that includes respect. Each side should know enough about the other's business to be able to assess it and opine upon it. But there's really got to be a level of trust that goes deeply there. And that's why I feel like respect becomes so important.
I'm talking with retired General Stanley Allen McChrystal, former top commander of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. The general recently came out in support of Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden. And, of course, we're discussing the issues for military families and service members ahead of this election. And, of course, the importance of this voting bloc in Florida. General, recent polling data shows that military households continue to support President Trump over Vice President Biden by a slim majority. Trump handedly carried the military vote back in 2016. What does Vice President Biden then have to do, before Tuesday, to win over more votes?
Yeah, I think what military have to do is everybody should make a reasoned decision on what they believe and who, regardless of who they vote for. But I would urge people not to reflexively go to one or two issues that seems to be important to you, the military budget or that, but to go things that are much more fundamental. Who would you want in the foxhole next to you? Who do you actually believe? Who do you trust? Because at the end of the day, our national leadership is based on character. In my entire career, I'd have rather worked for a leader of great character that I could trust and I knew would come for me than one who might be a genius of something else. And so I think that military is actually a very thoughtful constituency, and I'm hopeful that they will consider it broadly and make a good decision.
As I mentioned, too, Florida has one of the largest military populations in the United States. It was in 2016, it was almost one in five of all absentee ballots from soldiers overseas were cast in Florida. But, you know, one of the concerns, General, obviously, in this election is, the Postal Service and making sure that those ballots get in on time. Have you heard any concern from service members or anybody overseas about, some of these issues that have been debated here?
I think there's been so much discussion in the media about it that everybody has concerns and doubts, although they may not be based on hard experience or fact. I think the bottom line, we've got to have an underlying idea that every vote should be counted. Every American should have an opportunity to vote. Every no suppression, no avoidance or anything, and then every vote should be counted. And there are a lot of tactics going on and discussions about it. I think that undermines people's confidence, and I think that's unfortunate.
In your time with the service, how significant was the Get Out the Vote campaigns overseas among soldiers? I mean, is this a politically motivated voting bloc?
It never was during my career. We never talked politics. I didn't know the political interest of anybody I served with because it was considered incorrect to do. So we would have voting efforts because we just thought it was everybody's responsibility to vote. But there was never an idea that we got to get out the vote for candidate X or candidate Y. If that creeps into our system, I think that would be unfortunate. The idea that we have a nonpartisan military has been a great American tradition, and I think it's very, very important we maintain that.
Do you think it's nonpartisan? Do you think that that's still the same as it was when you were in the service?
I think there are probably pressures to make it more partisan, but I think that we need to step back and say that while you're in uniform, you've got to be as careful to understand that your role is apolitical as you can possibly be. Now, I think every soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine should vote. I think that's their right and their responsibility. But that's on an individual level, and that is not to be politicking inside the ranks.
And the other thing, too, is with soldiers, they're in a unique position. I mean, the life they live and the sacrifices they make. I wondered, are the issues that are important to different voters in the United States the same for soldiers? Like the economy or immigration or abortion or anything? I mean, do they see things differently?
I think every group in America, and I don't want to pool people too much, has their own perspective from their experience, whether it's somebody who works in the energy industry or healthcare or education. You're going to be colored by your experiences. So the military has some. They certainly have a greater role in national security and the mechanics of that, the defense budget probably. But also all of the basic things. Their children still have got to be educated. They've still got to live in safe communities. So I think that the overlap is much greater than any differences.
One other thing, too, that's popped up that's, of course, probably the biggest topic of this election, which is the pandemic. And veterans in Florida are facing this crisis because access to physical and mental health services, especially during the pandemic, have been very challenging. And the pandemic has hospitalized thousands of veterans in Florida. How do you see the treatment of veterans and access to health care playing out in this election?
Well, I'm going to take it from the macro sense. A good military commander is honest with the people that they lead, tells them what the real situation is, and then makes difficult decisions. And so I think this pandemic is a very real threat, particularly to older veterans. And so our unwillingness to stand up and take on what is, in effect, a national security threat to the United States of a different kind. I think that is our biggest failure. And that's a failure of leadership and a failure of being strong-willed. This is a time when, essentially, the United States is at war against a virus, and we have to act like it.
I'm going to finish with this because, I mean, we talk about being at war with a virus. I started the conversation with the issue of terror. But one other threat that I wanted to talk about, we had a conversation a number of years ago with retired Vice Admiral Lee Gunn with the U.S. Navy, and he discussed, aside from those external threats, he talked about climate change and the existential threat to Florida, to the nation, to the military. And I just wanted your take on, is this something that's being discussed within the military? What is the threat climate change brings, you know, for national security?
That's a great question. Thanks for asking. And it's a huge threat. And we'll start on the simplistic level. If the climate in the United States changes, if our water is bad, if the seas start to rise, we're going to have big problems in coastal areas like Florida. But then take it more broadly. If you have significant climate change around the world, you're going to have a degradation of life, a degradation of arable land, available water, things like that. That's going to create unrest around the world. We're now in a world where unrest in one part of the world quickly moves to others. Mass migration of refugees, things like that. And soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and their families are going to be involved in that very quickly. So You know, one of the things I sometimes tell people, a good disciplined military unit that goes to the field and it goes into the woods and, for example, and camps, the first thing they have to learn is how to be disciplined so they don't ruin the ecology in the area or everybody gets sick. If you don't dig latrines, if you don't find good water sources, if you don't do basic things, then you ruin your local environment. If we ruin our local environment, we can't live in it. And so we're now coming to grips with the fact that we have started to ruin the world's environment, and we've got to reverse that.
And really fascinating what you just said, too, is the same thing the Vice Admiral said. As we see climate change create unrest around the world, it's the U.S. military that's likely the one that's going to be called to get involved to do something. So, General Stanley Allen McChrystal, former top commander of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. General, it's been an honor. Thank you so much.
Sure, it's mine. Thank you.
Well, still to come, how are the campaigns now trying to win over Latin voters? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Political analysts say there is no path to the White House without Latino voters. Joe Biden has a narrow lead among Florida Latino voters. That's according to a new poll from Telemundo. Still, his performance is well behind Hillary Clinton's 2016 numbers, and she still lost the state. Latinos are the largest minority group to ever take part in an election, with 32 million eligible to vote this year. Are both parties doing enough to get this diverse population out to the polls? Earlier today, we spoke with the New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei about how both campaigns are targeting the Latino vote here in the Sunshine State. I've heard for years, you know, that the Latin vote is the key to winning Florida, but how are campaigns actually looking at this voter bloc right now?
Well, it's definitely one of the top targets for both sides. It usually is, just because Florida elections are so close that you need every piece of the puzzle of whatever your coalition is to be coming together. And so if you're a Democrat, you tend to be looking to run up your numbers among Latinos who tend to lean Democratic, except for Cuban Americans. And if you're a Republican, you want to make sure those Republican-leaning Cuban Americans go out to vote and that your margin is closer so that you are not losing by such a big number, and that way the whole election can stay close or you can win.
You know, I'm wondering, since when you say Latino, you're talking about this big group of people. Should we even be using that term? Should we say Latino voter? Because, you know, you have Cubans and Venezuelans and Colombians and Puerto Ricans, and every group is coming from a very different place with very different issues that are top of mind. But should we even say that?
Yeah, I've asked myself that same question. It's a good one. I mean, I think most political observers and operatives would tell you that there is sort of a broader Latino vote to look at. But smart campaigns do break them down, as you noted, into more specific groups based on where they're coming from, which is why you can hear, for example, campaign ads in Spanish that are dubbed with different accents. So you can have some ads that sound like a Mexican-American accent, and some sound like a Puerto Rican accent, some sound like a Cuban accent, because different groups like to feel represented and also have slightly different ways of viewing things and slightly different issues that motivate them to vote.
When you look at this election, like, what are some of those big differences that jump out between, the Cuban vote, the Venezuelan vote, the Puerto Rican vote? Like, what's the most important thing possibly for each of these groups? They're not, because, again, it's to point out, Latino is not monolith. It's not all the same.
Well, obviously, if you're coming from a different country in South America and you're either an immigrant or a second generation and you're Colombian American, for example, you care a lot about U.S. policy towards Colombia. Same thing about Venezuelans with U.S. policy towards Venezuelans. Cubans about U.S. policy toward Cuba. Puerto Ricans have different interests, of course, because they're U.S. citizens and they have more concerns about what the U.S. policy is towards territories and legislation that affects them and the fact that they're not represented in Congress and the statehood question. So every one of those groups has slightly different motivations. We often see, you know, immigration being an issue that gets talked about to appeal to people from a lot of countries at once, even if that's not the top issue for people, just because it's sort of a way into talking about other issues. It's like a gateway issue if you are empathetic or compassionate or talk about immigration in a way that is welcoming to people who are immigrants themselves or children of immigrants, then they'll want to listen to you when you talk about jobs, healthcare, and education. Broadly speaking, though, Latinos usually tend to be concerned with the economy, with education, and with healthcare.
So 4 years ago, Hillary Clinton had a very big lead with Latino voters, but what's changed? What do the figures tell us what's happening right now?
Well, you know, every day is a different poll or two to look at, and a battle over, you know, which poll is right, and campaigns pushing back or promoting the ones that that favor them. I think what we can say that most people would agree with in either campaign for president right now is that it is unlikely for former Vice President Joe Biden to match Hillary Clinton's numbers in Florida, in part because at the time, you know, before he was president, President Trump was sort of an unknown quantity who was known to a lot of Latinos for his harsh remarks on immigration. And so people who normally might have voted for a Republican either did not vote or voted for Clinton. So 2016 was sort of a weird year. You know, in Florida particularly, there was some resentment among some Latino voters, including Cuban-American Republicans, about how Trump had defeated Marco Rubio, how he had treated Jeb Bush. And so those hard feelings were still lingering in 2016, and they're not anymore. The president has made up a lot of ground with those Cuban-American Republicans and with other Latinos. We've seen this in national polls, too, where the non-white voters have been doing better for the president. So generally speaking, I think both sides would agree that Biden is not expected to match Clinton's numbers in 2016. The question is, will he match, for example, former President Barack Obama's support among Latinos in 2012? Or will President Trump do better than Obama did back then? And that's sort of the margin game that they're playing.
How about the Black Lives Matter protests of this summer and all the discussion about law enforcement? How is that playing out right now with the Latino voter?
Well, you'll see Republicans, not just the president, but also down the ballot, really trying to leverage a message of law and order that seems geared at Latinos that they're using in some of their Spanish mail and other advertising, because I think they are sort of, you know, trying to suggest that some of the protests, if they were not peaceful, is something that could be a really big problem. And that is a message that must be resonating because they keep using it. So they must have some sort of metric that suggests that that's working, including among Latino voters. On the other hand, I think in a place like Miami, there has been some discussion about, you know, what participation Latinos did or did not have in some of those protests and what that said about, you know, solidarity, I guess, between Hispanics or African-Americans. And I think those are ongoing conversations that in some cases have resulted in some people being more active politically, right? And in some cases have been people being sort of turned off by political activism. I don't think we know really yet what the ultimate effect is going to be.
Let's take a look at the Cuban-American vote in Miami. You know, when we saw with Barack Obama, we saw a generational divide. Is that still the case? Younger Cuban-Americans leaning one way compared to their parents or grandparents? What's changed in this election?
So what the polls suggest is that second and third generation Cuban Americans have continued to drift away from the Republican Party, which is what we have seen happening for the past maybe decade or so, and what people sort of thought was Florida's demographic destiny with Cuban American voters. But a new phenomenon has been that more recent Cuban immigrants, so people who arrived from Cuba, say in the past, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, have previously been sort of disengaged politically, not that involved in American politics. And the ones who are citizens are now becoming registered Republicans and identifying with President Trump. And so that's why you have seen sort of this big push for Cuban supporters for Trump in these car caravans, you know, across Miami-Dade County, for example, on some weekends. There's a lot of sort of social media influencers and YouTube personalities who try to drive this point. And that is something that we've seen, for example, for the FIU poll of Cuban Americans that comes out every 2 years for the first time found that more of these newer Cuban immigrants were registering as Republicans, were identifying with President Trump. And that is a different sort of turn that had not really been predicted. And so the question is, did Democrats miss an opportunity?
Well, let me ask you this, because you got the chance to speak directly with voters and, you know, wanted to hear, you know, like some examples, some stories perhaps of, you know, from the younger Republican voters, or the younger voters, and where they're leaning, and some of these new Cubans you said who are coming in and why they think the way they do.
I think it's a complicated explanation. In some ways, it's frustration over the situation in Cuba, which is a feeling familiar with generations of Cuban Americans here. And some people, it sounds like, might be channeling that frustration towards Obama, towards the policy of engagement that was reversed by President Trump. And so one of the theories, you know, among Cuban Americans who support Biden is that because that policy was not in place very long, you know, a couple of years, probably not long enough to take full effect. And also because the Cuban government just did not really seem eager to change despite that policy, that the end point where we are now, where to the situation in Cuba is very difficult for people who still have relatives there and who have traveled there back and forth, is just this feeling of help, you know, powerlessness again and frustration. And so you're like, well, if what President Obama tried didn't work, and this is where we're at now, we're going to keep supporting President Trump because he's taking a harder line. And because the Cuban government showed that when the U.S. took a softer, more engaging line with them, they didn't do anything to change. Right. So some of it could be that. There is also, frankly, a discussion among Cuban Americans who support President Trump that they say his style is something that appeals to Cuban voters. He's sort of got a bravado about him. They sort of like that he, you know, says things plainly. And to the point that some will tell you that they appreciate what is called mano dura, right? An iron fist against the left in the United States. And that's obviously a controversial statement because, you know, a lot of people who are in South Florida fled precisely that sort of rule in other countries.
If I may actually jump in, you know, how much too, because I know that the president has also tried to push, you know, as you said, kind of like a tough guy kind of persona, how much of that machismo thing plays into this?
So one of my colleagues at the New York Times wrote a story, I think it was out of Arizona, about the machismo that appeals to Latino men. And the president has more support among men than women across the board, across races and ethnicities. It is obviously also true among Latino men. And so she was trying to examine that phenomenon that we see, which is that some Latino men just like the way the president speaks and goes about things. And what I think the president likes to say is not being politically correct is how he puts it, which obviously a lot of people would tell you is no. I mean, what you're saying is either offensive or false or racist, depending on what the case may be. So there's some of that, too. I don't know that in the middle of the election, we know exactly what the explanation for everything we see is. We just know sort of what the polls suggest. And we'll have to see if that is also what the eventual vote results show.
You mentioned Obama a couple of times, and he's been in South Florida and pushing really hard to counter that message of Biden is a socialist, the left is socialist. But he never talked about, or he doesn't really say a whole lot about his time in Cuba and all that. Why?
I feel like the people who supported the president's engagement policy at the time, you know, supported him strongly and probably support Vice President Biden strongly. I'm not sure how many new voters or undecided voters you win over by bringing that up again, especially if you know that there are people who are frustrated with the situation in Cuba. And someone like Obama could blame Trump, right, and say, well, the situation in Cuba is dire because we reversed the policy. But at the end of the day, the situation in Cuba is what it is because of the Cuban government. and people have just such strong feelings in whatever side that they're in, that if you're just trying to persuade new people to go vote or those people who are on the fence, I'm not sure how many people that wins you over.
All right, so let's take a look. I mean, you've been kind of discussing it, you know, some of the differences in how the campaigns are looking at these different groups. But what have you seen in the actual campaigning, and whether it's ads on social media? How is Biden approaching the Latin vote? How is Trump approaching them? What are they doing specifically?
Well, going into the last few days of voting, for example, we're seeing that the Biden campaign is doing a lot of events targeting each specific group a little bit differently. So they have these Chiva buses for Colombian American votes, voters, and they're using the word chinchorrear in Orlando, which is a very Puerto Rican term for, you know, hanging out and having a good time. They're talking about La Hora Loca, which is something Venezuelans do when they party. It's sort of like the, you know, at midnight in a big wedding, they will bring out the party favors or whatever. And they're using that term for like peak voting hours in early voting sites. They're bringing out DJs and celebrities in Central Florida and in Tampa to attract people to the polls. The Trump campaign has basically been, you know, sticking to the strategy that worked for the president in 2016. It almost looks like he's trying to replicate that feeling from the last few days of the election, which is when exit polls suggested that Trump ended up really consolidating his lead against Clinton, which was having all these rallies back to back to back and going to lots of places and getting a lot of that earned media, which is what we call when people like us in the news business cover something and it's not just an ad. The president's campaign has been having less money to campaign with. So when they go to more places and travel, they get news coverage, and that makes up for the loss in TV ads, for example.
All right, so we talked about the Black Lives Matter movement. What about the pandemic? I mean, it has disproportionately impacted Black and Latino communities. How is that going to play out?
That is something that we've seen the Biden campaign try to stress to people. It even shows up in the way they have campaigned, right? They did not go door to door. They still don't have big events that are not invitation only. Vice President Biden in Florida today is having drive-in rallies and not rallies with people in person because they don't think it's safe. Whereas you see President Trump having rallies with people sort of all bunched up together and not necessarily wearing masks. So they're really diametrically different approaches to how they see people being able to live with the virus in the middle of campaign season. And when you interview voters at the polls, it's striking. You'll talk to Biden voters and they will bring up the pandemic and that they're worried about it and they don't like how the president has managed it. And you talk to Trump voters and they'll tell you that they're not worried, that they think that the president has done a good job and that we, you know, people have to make their own choices about staying inside or going outside or wearing a mask or not.
And then what about immigration? I mean, you had, you know, within the last few years, the big stories about children in camps and, you know, the president ending TPS and a lot of people being deported, but yet don't hear a lot about the issue of immigration. Not as much as I thought.
No, that's also been something that has been notable about this campaign. Immigration has really not been at the forefront. I think it did not come up until the last debate and maybe one of the town halls previously. But before that, in the general election, had just not been a big topic of discussion. And I don't know if that means that it's a secondary issue or that neither of the candidates has as much of a vested interest in bringing it up, right? Because President Trump has had this issue with family separations that is not popular. And Vice President Biden, when he was in the Obama administration, they had a huge number of deportations at the time that were very controversial, that the vice president sort of hinted that he was not in favor of and that he would not do as president. But you don't, you know, as a candidate, if you're spending all the time explaining, you're not getting out your message now. So perhaps because neither of the candidates super eager into discussing their past records on immigration is one of the reasons why we have not seen it come up as much.
And of course, the Republicans have championed the issue of abortion. Is that going to play a role with the Latino voter?
I think one of the things people forget about is in the diversity of the Latino community, there's also a lot of religious conservatives, including evangelicals, including Catholics. That's true in Central Florida as it is in Arizona. And so Republicans have made a concerted effort for years now to reach out to those folks. If you pay attention in Miami to the way candidates campaign, There's a lot of Democrats who go to black churches on Sundays when elections are going on, but you see a lot of Republicans go to Latino churches. And that's because they have identified that group as potentially a growth part of the Republican Party. And so we've talked to conservative Latinos who in some cases are a little torn because they have, the abortion issue matters to them, the Supreme Court matters to them, and then perhaps they also have an immigration concern, right? And they're sort of weighing which one of those to end up voting for.
So this year we see the Latino vote make up the largest minority group of eligible voters, but do we expect high turnout?
That's always a big question for the Latino electorate. It tends to underperform, which means not come out in the numbers that its population would suggest. And though, for example, the Biden campaign feels very good about the fact that a lot of Latinos have voted early, which is not something Latinos usually do. And obviously, this is a very weird year, and a lot of people are voting early. I don't know if we're going to see, a better performance overall nationally or in the state by Latinos yet.
Let me finish with this. Oftentimes, minority groups will claim that politicians are just pandering them for votes, and then they get in office, and that's it. They're forgotten. I mean, do Latinos feel that way about whether it's Democrats or Republicans, that you're just trying to win my vote now, and then you're going to forget me?
You know, I think that happens with people who are in groups that are not just Latinos after elections. Perhaps it happens less in communities that feel like they helped win an election for a candidate. So I don't know that Cuban American Republicans would tell you that they have been forgotten by President Trump. If anything, they've been pretty pleased at the amount of attention that he has showered on them since being elected. But generally speaking, yes, that is a complaint that you hear from Latino voters, especially Puerto Rican voters, I would say, who I interview a lot, who tend to feel that, they get discussed every 4 years. It's like, they can be change makers. And then the issue of Puerto Rico sort of goes to the back burner. So, that just tends to be a problem we see cycle after cycle.
That was New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei. You can read more of her reporting about the Latino vote in Florida by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, Florida has a plan for distributing its COVID-19 vaccine. Who will get access to it first? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, when there's a COVID-19 vaccine ready, have you asked the question, who's going to get it first? The federal government mandated that every state come forward with a plan for distribution of the vaccine once one becomes available. Florida's draft vaccination distribution plan was made public last week. The draft plan has three stages for distribution, with different groups receiving priority. There are still a lot of questions, though, about how millions of Floridians will be able to access the vaccine in a timely manner. Well, joining us now via Zoom is Christine Sexton, health reporter for the News Service of Florida. Christine, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Christine, in Florida's draft vaccination plan, what populations are first in line?
Sure. Well, the state right now is following some CDC initial guidelines. So Florida is going to target those vaccinations when they come out to hospital staff and staff at long-term care facilities, first responders, and then residents at long-term care facilities.
All right. So, especially when we're looking at folks like seniors, they're in that seniors, whether they're in elder care or not, seniors, are they in that first phase?
Well, the first phase is really going to be, it's going to be in for the staff that work at the long-term care facilities, but for the residents who also work, for the residents who live there. So if you're 65 and living in the community, you're not going to be in that initial first phase. That first phase, the state thinks the amount of vaccinations that will be coming will be somewhat limited. So they really want to target it to those frontline workers and, hospital workers, long-term care workers, first responders, as well as people in nursing homes who live there, because we know that they're at risk.
So everything, again, there's phases, kind of like the reopening of the state. There are phases, and each phase will be a different group that will be able to access the vaccine. Obviously, Christine, this would be a vaccine distribution unlike anything in U.S. history. But what experience does Florida have that it could say, this is, you know, we can lean back on this as a reference when we talk about this kind of logistical endeavor?
Sure. Well, when the state put together this this draft plan, what they did was they went back and they looked at how they distributed vaccines during the H1N1 pandemic, how they distribute even seasonal flu vaccines, right? And also there was a recent vaccination campaign for hepatitis A that our health secretary, Scott Rivkes, launched. So they went back and they looked at those efforts and what they did right and what they did wrong and, you know, where improvements could be made. So this is kind of where you're seeing this plan come from. But you're right. I mean, I don't think anyone is going to see this kind of amount of vaccinations.
Yeah, we've never seen any. Out. We haven't seen anything like this. But do state officials, have they already at least started thinking about what some of those first challenges, early challenges, are going to be?
Yeah. Well, you know, at least in phase one, when you say I'm going to get it to the frontline healthcare workers, you actually need to know how many there are. So the state's been working with hospitals. It's been working with nursing homes. It's actually pulling you know, licensure data, how many doctors are licensed in South Florida, you know, how many doctors are licensed in North Florida. And they're trying to figure out the numbers of frontline workers that they would need to get vaccinations for, right? So, and they also need, it's not just about the numbers of vaccinations, but it's also potentially about the vaccinations themselves. It's very likely that they'll need to be stored in very cold storage. So not every hospital may have the ability to store these vaccinations.
Yeah,
right?
They're surveying
hospitals and departments to see what their storage capability is like, and also the amount of storage that they can handle.
Yeah.
You know, how many vials are going to be coming in. And so the states, those are some logistical things that they're trying to look at. And they're working with large groups to try to get that kind of data.
Yeah. Again, talking with News Service of Florida health reporter Christine Sexton, the Florida Department of Health again released its draft plan for distribution of a COVID-19 vaccine once there is one. And you can find her reporting on our social media at WLRN Sundial. All right, Christine, we talked about phase one. What does phase two and phase three look like?
Sure. Well, phase two, and you know, also we have no idea since there is no vaccination, we have no idea when these phases.
Oh yeah, everything is about when when the vaccine is available. Then we have the phases. We don't know yet.
Right. So the second phase kicks in when they expect that there should be enough supply of the vaccination that they can start doing other kind of mass vaccination efforts. And that's going to involve the county health departments and working with the State Division of Emergency Management. But even then, that's only going to be at targeted populations. And then I think in that targeted population is when you're going to see seniors, you know, people over the age of 65.
So
kind of similarly to what the COVID testing, right?
Yes.
Initially, it was very limited. And then, you know, then it went out to certain populations. So phase two, they still think that they may have less supply than what they need. So they're still going to kind of be a little conservative there.
So basically the average person like myself would have to wait till phase three.
Yeah. Phase three starts kicking in you know, the general public is going to kick in with phase three, to be honest with you.
And at that point, is it just something where I can go to my doctor, or kind of like the COVID tests, they're only going to be located in specific areas?
Well, you know, I think it depends on who you are. The general public, just like you could with the COVID testing, phase three, the general public, they would be able to go to these sites that are run from the county health departments. And phase three, maybe the general public could go to a hospital, right? And a hospital that would be willing to work with the state on vaccination efforts, right? Stage three, you're also maybe going to be able to get it just commercially through your health insurance plan, like at a pharmacy, right?
Right, right.
But it would be more routine at that point.
Right. At that point, they have more than enough for the rest of us. One of the interesting pieces included in the draft plan that you pointed out is county administrations are being asked to run a vaccination administration exercise before December 1st. Okay, what is that?
What that is the state telling the county health departments, and the county health departments, there's a health department in every county, there's 67 of them, but they are playing a big role in this, right? And so the state is saying to them, we want you, they are currently distributing influenza vaccinations, right? So what they're saying is, while you're giving out these flu vaccinations, we want you to one day go ahead and try to react like this is a COVID vaccination. So they want them to wear protective personal equipment. They want them to think about social distancing people. And actually, they want to try to get more people in the doors, just, in case they do have large demands that show up.
Yeah.
So they want these county health departments to increase the people who are coming in, but then to also, kind of as a practice run, wear PPE, make these people stay 6 feet away.
They want to turn.
And how does it go? You know, give us your observations.
Yeah, they want to turn, I guess, a regular vaccination into, a mock trial, I guess.
Yeah, almost like a test run, right? Yeah. And the county health departments, the states put together a template. So, you know, each county health department, they're going to be filling out a similar form so they can respond the same way. And the state tries to, learn from it.
Yeah. What are some of the big questions that remain unanswered for you in your reporting on this story?
Oh, well, speaking of the county health departments, I guess to me, a question is, can they do this? And the reason I bring that up is, over the last decade, at least, there have been really deep cuts made to the state's public health programs, right? It's not just the programs and what does public health do, but it's the staff that work there. And that was a reflection of the former governor. It's a reflection of Republican leadership. What is the role of state in public health? And like I said, there have been really deep reductions. And it's interesting because in the upcoming legislative budget request, right, these lawmakers and these secretaries, they're having to think about what is my budget going to look like for next year. And the Department of Health Secretary, he acknowledged that, the public health program is strained. And he has asked lawmakers for $7 million so he can hire additional staff. And so to me, there's an acknowledgement there that you need to beef up the infrastructure.
That's
$7 million to hire 68 positions.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
A little disconcerting that our health system needs a little bit more, knowing this vaccine isn't even out there yet. Again, talking with News Service of Florida health reporter Christine Sexton. Learn more about Florida's COVID-19 vaccine plan on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Christine, thanks so much for the insight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And again, that's all dependent on when the vaccine is actually available. But don't worry, we'll always keep you informed. We'll always let you know what's going on next. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, October 29th. Coming up next week on Sundial, well, of course, there's this thing, probably heard about it, the election, right? We'll be bringing you all of our election coverage on Monday with a look at the critical races in our region. There will be special coverage on election night, beginning at 7 p.m. as the polls close in partnership with NPR. You can always stay up to date on your local, state, and national political news at WLRN.org and on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Plus, we're going to look at one vulnerable population to this virus that hasn't received a lot of media coverage, those people behind bars. We hear the story of an inmate in Broward County about the conditions in the jails and what's being done to keep prisoners safe. All of that and more coming up next week on the program. As always, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can always email us if you've got a comment or question about the program, sundial@wlrnnews.org. And as always, I'd say, stay safe, be good to each other, have a wonderful Friday, have a great weekend. Get out to vote if you have the chance. We'll talk to you again live on Monday.